So today we're going to start talking about the flood itself. We won't finish the flood itself today. And I'm going to direct us away from some of those conversations that some of you guys are like, oh, I really want to have talk about dinosaurs. We're not talking about that right now. We might talk about that later, but not right now. Right now, I want to talk about the flood. I want to focus our attention as cosmic collapse, because I really think this is the way the Bible's, when we read it in its context, because that's what we're trying to do, right? That's one of the first things we're asking. We're not asking, the first thing, that since we started Genesis, the first thing we've been focusing on is not what the Bible means to me or what it says to me or what I feel it's saying. It's what did it say to them? That's the first question we're asking. What does it say to them? And then we let that determine how it affect how it's speaking to us personally. So we're going to read. We're in Genesis chapter 7, 6 through 16. So if you've got your Bible, flip open there. I'll have it on the screen, though I don't always not always the best at keeping us on that page, as you know. Best to have it in your own. Of course, you can follow along in the notes as well on the app to see all the information. Genesis 7, 6 through 16. Now Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters came upon the earth. 600 years old. Then Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him entered the ark because the water of the flood. Of the clean animals and the animals that are not clean and the birds and everything that creeped on the ground, there went into the ark to Noah by twos, male and female, as God commanded Noah. And it came about after 7 days that the water of the flood came upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on the same day, all the fountains of the great deeps burst open and the floodgates of the sky, the heavens, it's actually plural, heavens, were opened. The rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and for 40 nights. On the same day, Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth and sons of Noah and Noah's wives and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They and every beast after its kind, and all the cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, every bird after its kind, all sorts of birds. So they went into the ark to Noah by twos of all the flesh, in which was the breath of life. Those that entered, male and female, all of the flesh entered as God commanded him, and the Lord closed it behind him. So we really have two sections here of the same story, leading many to think that there's actually two versions, two sources that were put together. But the authors aren't that dumb. So if we ask them, well, if they're basically telling two different stories here, what's going on here? But these two sections are highlighting two different sets of animals. The first list is pure animals. In this one right here, you have more of a Genesis chapter 1 list, right? It very much sounded like Genesis chapter 1, didn't it? It's supposed to bring you back to that idea of Genesis chapter 1. The first one that we read earlier was all about priestly animals. This section is all about Genesis 1. So this point is highlighting them to that the animals of different kinds are meaning. This is creation and sacrifices. In the 600th year of Noah's life, so the moment when the floodwaters are released, it's been how long? How many years? How many years since Noah? Noah was told. 120. Mm-hmm. 120 years. So this is the moment when the waters first were released. They were split apart. All the fountains of the great deep and the windows of the skies were opened. It says floodgates were opened. The windows is another way you could translate the same Hebrew word. So you have like the they were split apart in the fountains of the deep and the skies. So we get this idea that there are windows up there that open and the fountains of the deep split apart, and the two waters, which correspond, right? When you hear the two waters, the waters from above and the waters below, those are corresponding to those waters that was found in Genesis chapter 1. Remember that? Now the land was, let's do a little refresher. Tohu vavohu. Formless and void, or wild and waste. And darkness was over the face of the Tahom. But the breath of Elohim was hovering like a hummingbird over the face of the Hamayim, this the waters. And so you have this this two water, this waters happening, and God in chapter 1, 6, and 7 said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters," and he separated the waters from waters. You have waters from above and the waters below. And the expanse was separated. Remember, we put that rakia in the sky. That rakia. So let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and it separated the dome and separated and God called the dome the dome skies, the heavens, and there was evening and the morning, the first day. In biblical cosmology, there it is. Remember, the way they saw the world is called cosmology, and they see the world very differently than we see the world. Remember, we have the blessing of things like telescopes and satellites, and they didn't have any of that. So they have to paint a picture of the world, and it's very different from the way they see the world. So they're describing what is going on through their cosmology, the way they saw the world. And they saw the world more like this. That doesn't mean this is how it is. Like, we know that there's, you know, space and, the OT. They didn't know anything about ozone layers or, they didn't know anything like that. This is how they saw the world. And so in the biblical cosmology, the waters above the Rakia are, even today, are still there. God is the one ongoing, sustaining work of creation, keeping the order of his cosmology from collapsing into chaos. And so his new creation, his creation work to separate waters from waters, isn't limited to just day two. But it's an ongoing thing. He separates waters from waters, and he's the one keeping it there. And it's a daily sustaining of it. Which comes into play, later on when he says, "I'm never going to flood the earth again." It's not that the waters are gone. I used them all up. No, he's daily sustaining. I'm not going to let this happen again. See Psalm 104. The waters are still up there. And God is keeping his promise to never flood the earth again because of his love. But he didn't just snap his fingers and make it go away. So they have more of this snow globe, right? And you know, when we have conversations on this, the flood, we often debate about things like historical references, and we usually throw words out there like literal or non-literal or literal and metaphorical. And the debates range between whether it was a literal local flood or it was a world flood or was it neither, or, you know. But I've really come to understand, and we could talk about the debates. We actually probably will talk about the late debate later. But when we enter into those debates, we're really missing the point of what the Bible's trying to teach us. Because it's not a history book. It's not a science book. This is the way they saw the world, so this is the way it was. And so they're trying to teach us something in this cosmology. So you're going to read a line that says, I think most of our English translations say that it was raining on the earth. But for biblical authors, they don't just mean globe, they mean on the land part where man lives. They use the word eretz, which means the dry land. So they have a very different view of the cosmos than we do. Genesis chapter 1, the temple, the Psalms, they have very different cosmology. And we've already looked at that, I know. But, you know, sometimes it helps us to review. But the language that describes the flood is describing neither a local nor a global flood, which this has been hard for me. It's not describing either a local or a global flood. It's describing a collapse of the cosmos altogether. Cosmic collapse. Because the real question is you know, when we ask, you know, do we read it literally, or, you know, the universe in their view is collapsing. Remember, God separated, the very first thing, the waters was, there was, the earth was tohu vavahu, formless and void, and he separated waters from waters and created a place, and now the waters are collapsing in. You know, that is a question that I think we can debate later on. That's not really what they were going for. We can ask, like, how did this really happen and stuff like that. But this is really what they were seeing, was that instead of us thinking about, did it really happen, did not happen, how much of the earth was covered of it, what they were saying was, okay, if God separated water from water and created a place for us to order, now he is taking that away. There's no place. Chaos is returning. Chaos is returning. And so that's how they want us to see us. That's what they're thinking about. They're not talking about, oh, what was this when the Grand Canyon was made, or you know, the dinosaurs died, or they, you know, none of those questions would have been relevant to them. So we can have that debate later, and it's an interesting, important question that we have to wrestle with, but it's not the first thing we should be asking, because this is what they were seeing, was that place that was safe and orderly that God had created, separated the water from water. The waters represented chaos. And he said that God is taking away, boom, taking away that order and that place of safety and that's the order and letting chaos reign once again. Except for this temple that floats. This Eden that floats. And last week, I know I saw your look over there. Last week we talked about how the ark represents Eden and the temple. So you can go back and listen to that. we have this whole, so the conversation we really need to start with is this place where God, the author of all creation, is decreating, is allowing decreation to happen. Because it's collapsed, the collapse of day two. And when he stops it from happening again, it's not like, oh, he is holding water from water, and he's going to never let his hand remove again. He's never going to let the rakia collapse again. And so when we take this biblical cosmology into consideration, the flood is a portrait of God's release of the order he's established so that the cosmos collapses itself. Joe, can you get that door real quick? I forgot to unlock it so he can get in. Thank you. I think I'm going to read a quote here. Did I put it on the screen? No, I did not. That's okay. We'll stick there for a minute. This is a quote from a German book. The use of water imagery in the description of Sheol, if you're interested. But, is it in the notes? Okay, it's in the notes. In Genesis 1, the reader is introduced to a world in which watery chaos rules supreme until God's intervention brings order. The flood account in Genesis 6 through 8 tells a story of how, when the world was corrupt, God withdrew the restraints placed on the water at the time of creation, and they flooded the world once more from the great deep to home Rabbah and the windows of the heavens. Thus, the chaos waters, by their very natures, are symbolic of absence of order and creation. In the flood narrative, they don't denote the reversal of creation. The word in the Hebrew, mabul, is the word we translate flood. It's a four-letter word, which actually, if you guys remember our discussion when we first started this whole thing, we did a thing on the Hebrew words. What was the roots? How many letters did the roots mostly have? You guys remember? I know it was like a long time ago, and most of you guys like Hebrew. Yeah, most words. Very good, Myra. Most words in the Hebrew have a root of three letters. And here we have a word that is four letters. But it appears 13 times in the Hebrew Bible. 12 of them are in this narrative. So let's go to the other one, right? That's always what we do. Psalm 29. In this psalm, it's a poem about how Yahweh's voice is over the waters. So, the voice of Yahweh is over the waters. The God of glory thunders. The Yahweh is over the great waters. The voice of Yahweh is in power. The voice of Yahweh in splendor. The voice of Yahweh breaks the cedars. That's kind of repetitive there. Skip down to 9. The voice of the Lord of Yahweh makes the deer give birth and strips the woodland bears. His temple all cry glory. Yahweh sits enthroned over the flood. The Lord sits enthroned in this king forever. That last one in verse 9, the Yahweh sits as king of Mabul. Yes, the Lord sits as king forever. So we have this Mabul there. We translate over the flood. There's a guy named Gerald von Rad, and he translates. This is a long quote. Yes, it's in the app. You can read this. I think it's kind of beautiful what he says. And he looks at Mabul a little differently. He says Mabul doesn't mean flood, inundation, or even destruction. But it is a technical term for a part of the world structure, namely the heavenly ocean. This heavenly sea, which is above the firmament, the Rakia, empties downwards through the lattice windows. Here we have the same realistic and cosmological ideas as in Genesis chapter 1. The flood, therefore, is a catastrophe involving the entire cosmos. When the heavenly ocean breaks forth upon the earth below and the primeval sea beneath the earth, which is restrained by God, now freed from its bonds, gushes up through a yawning chasm into the earth. When there is a destruction of the entire cosmic system, according to the biblical cosmology, the two halves of the chaotic primeval sea separate the other below by God's creative government, are again united, creating. Creation begins to seek again into chaos. Here the catastrophe therefore concerns not only men and beasts, but the earth, indeed the entire cosmos. So he doesn't think it's just the word flood, it's a part of the very nature of the earth, that the waters being crashed back together again. So in other words, the heavenly ocean and the waters above. So you see what he's getting at here? And it's okay if you're going to disagree with him. But it's not like in the Bible, the waters above are still there. So if you're going to say it's just waters below and it's just a normal flood, then we have to deal with how the floods, the idea that Yahweh still sits as king over Mabul, not just one time, but for all time, he's still sitting up there. So one thing we're saying is that the flood is more than just creek rows. which in Kentucky happens all the time. Sometimes you want it to rise and trap you on the other side. Sometimes you don't. I remember praying that the creek rises because I didn't want to go to work, but this is, cosmology. So we're supposed to see that as God has released them to their own desires, as Paul puts it, the desires of their hearts as they were corrupt. And he has allowed chaos to once again crash upon, except the floating ark, basket, temple. So as we read this, there's, and we go go all the way back to the, if you go back and read as they're entering in the ark, there's almost a drumbeat emphasis on the people going in. If you read it in the Hebrew, it's really kind of methodical, repetitive, both within family and the animals. But it feels, especially in the Hebrew, like a liturgical parade or a ritual march into the temple. And that's the way it's supposed to make you feel. I think we miss some of it in the English, you know, which is, you know, it's fine. We can't capture all of that because, you know, we're translating it. But it's supposed to feel like a ritual march into the temple. You know, in the Bible, there aren't any instructions on how the priests were to do a lot of their jobs. But a lot of what the priest actually did survives later Jewish literature, around the time of Jesus. So when you were talking about all the priesthood and what they do and what they do, it's about the time of Jesus, you can read that every detail of where you are and who moves and in what order and when the choir speaks and when the Levites, and it was all very orchestrated. It was very planned out. Wasn't like we do here at the church. We kind of let it flow. I mean, we kind of have our basic outline, right? Welcome, three songs. But we kind of flow a little bit, don't we? I call up the, you know, and say, hey, stay seated. I got something else I want to say. You know, in the time of Jesus and literature, if you read the literature, it's very much planned out. Everything is planned out. And that's kind of what this feels like to me. This is a ritual march, everything very planned out to enter into the temple. It's very priestly in its nature. So as they go in, it's all orderly and organized, two by two, by two by two. They go in. And that's interesting to think about. All this chaos is about to flood in, right? Chaos. And here's this place of that they're marching in order, God's order, and he's going to preserve order in this little boat. So that's very beautiful in this sacred space. And so I think these texts, the authors, I think, have thought about all this. And so it's very methodically written down this way because they want you to preserve the idea that order is being preserved through by God, by his grace in this place. Here's another one of those weird ones. You're like, I don't know, I hadn't thought about that. Eden, the Ark, Tabernacle, temples, they all make these parallels in this narrative about entering a divine provided sanctuary to escape the creation going back to disorder. The word in Hebrew, I actually put this in your notes because it's interesting. The word go, went, enter, those are all the same word. It's the word bo. The repetition recalls the unique emphasis upon the door interest, which they're entering into divine refuge. And Noah, righteous and blameless, his moral character is entering in. I mean, we had a whole class on his righteousness, right? The entire collection of themes, which will actually be developed later in the Hebrew Bible, but Noah's righteous entrance righteous Noah's interest in the ark becomes the archetype of David's desire to take refuge in the temple, and the righteous remnant to long to enter the temple of the day of Yahweh. And Well, I read from Psalm 15. O Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell in your holy hill? He who walks with integrity and works with righteousness and speaks with truth in his heart. David pulling back on the idea of who gets to enter into the holy space. Noah, the righteous Noah, he wants to be like that, when I get to enter into the holy space. Or in Psalm 24, earth is Yahweh's with its fullness, the world and those who live in it, because it was founded on the seas and is established on its rivers. Who may ascend the mountain of Yahweh? Who may stand in this holy place? He who is innocent, hands of pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to falseness or to swear deceitfully. He will receive the blessing of Yahweh. Justice from God is his salvation. Such is sort of those who seek him or seek your face, even Jacob, Shelah. Lift up your heads, O gates, and rise up, O ancient doorways. The King of glory may enter. Who is the King of glory? Yahweh is strong and mighty. Yahweh is mighty in war. Lift up your head, O gates. Lift up, O ancient doorways, and the King of glory may enter. Those whose glory of Yahweh hosts, he is the King of glory. Shelah. You guys remember what Shelah means? It's like praise. It's a word that we actually don't have a translation for. That's why we just use the lid. People have said multiple things that it might mean, but in truth, we don't know. It's a word. Break. It's a musical word. We find it in these psalms that are very musical. Shelah. So we just use it, Shelah, because we don't know what it means. Maybe. I mean, we don't actually know what it means. So, the ark, the tabernacle, we already made those parallels beyond it. Beyond their constructions, they emphasize the construction. The ark and the tabernacle also have a relationship in that they are conditionally entered upon. Right? Not everyone can enter into the tabernacle. Not everyone can enter into the ark. It states that the unblemished, the tamim, animals may present it at the entrance of the tent before Yahweh, as the tabernacle, the temple in its architecture, they enter in. Who gets to enter in? And so there's this idea that's set back in Noah. Who gets to enter in? The righteous do. Everyone else is kept out. I think I'm going to skip that one. Do I want to go into this right now? I mean, I can make it through it. I'm just not sure if I want to do it tonight. You know what? We've been going quite a bit. I've thrown quite a bit at you. I know we've only gone for 46 minutes. That's enough, isn't it? Some of you are like, yeah. What comments do we have on this subject right now? No, you go ahead. Ask. Yeah. Okay. The Mesopotamian floods. Okay. For those of you guys who weren't here, I handed out all the Mesopotamian floods that have similarities to the. You can find those online as well. Uh-huh. We actually haven't talked about that. We're going to talk about that a little bit later as we enter in that debate. There are multiple ways people look at this. Because when we start getting into that debate, we're asking a question that I don't think they would have answered. The whole world collapsed. But they also know that things survive till afterwards. I mean, look at the Gibborim. We see people groups that are before the flood as well as after the flood. And I don't think they knew about it. It's not like they're dumb, like, oh, I don't know. But this is a question that would not have mattered to them. And sometimes I think if we put those questions in there, what I've said before, if we're asking a question and we're not getting the answer we want, maybe we're asking the wrong question. There's what you're referencing to is a passage that says it's 120 years. And there's two ways people have looked at that. We already talked about this, but there's 120 years. Some people say it was referencing to man's shortened lifespan. Some people say it was 120 years till Noah, the flood actually comes. So he's building it for 120 years. Now, I personally take the path that it was 120 years till he actually, not the shortened lifespan, because some people after the flood do live longer than 120 years. But we are going to see people live shorter lifespans as time goes on, healthcare and making bad choices and contamination of the earth and destruction. And I mean, a lot of things go into that play. So we are going to see people live Well, that's possible. Radiation from the sun, gravitational pulls also could play an effect in all that. This is kind of nerdy. If gravity is heavier, when you're living in that moment, it feels like a normal 24 hours. But if you look, and then you go to another time period in the future, and you have gravity is lesser, then when you looked back, it would seem like they lived longer because the time does not match up because time is affected by gravity. There's a whole nerdy physics and thing like that that was talking about that. And I don't know if I completely understand it all, but someone was telling me all about how time would be different if gravity was heavier versus lighter. And yeah, so there's different, first place I ever heard about it was a Ken Ham book about creation, and it was okay. I'm not a huge fan of Ken Ham, but he does have some good, you know, like if you want to take that point of view, he's very good. But then I started reading some physics books on the matter of time, because, you know, that's what I do, and they were talking about how it could, you know, gravitational forces could, like, we're looking back on time, it seems like it's different because time is relative because of gravitational forces. And like I said, it was something like, I'm not a physicist, I'm not going to pretend to be one. that is something that's interesting to think about, not necessarily in the Bible, so therefore I don't, a lot of theories out there, a lot of theories, we don't know. We don't know. The reality is, that's why I tend to stick to like what the Bible tells us. This is a cosmic collapse, and we're supposed to see this is a place that God has removed his blessing, turned us over to the desire's heart, as Paul says in Romans, but preserved some righteous in a temple. And now he's going to rebuild and he has a plan that this whole thing is going to culminate. We're starting to see themes. Like one person can represent all of humanity as we build to Abraham and then Isaac and Jacob and on down through the lines to Jesus Christ. Yeah, Bible, unified story. As the Bible Project says, unified story that leads to Jesus. I love the way they put that. But it's, so yes, lots of theories out there, and you can go read many, many, many books on the subject. My emphasis as I teach is what the Bible says, and some things we're just going to say, I don't know. Any other questions? All right. Well, let's pray. Next week, we'll talk about the flood covering the land, and we'll get into God remembering his little people on a boat. And we'll talk about where Mount Sinai is and the Ararat. Ararat. Sinai is another story, right? We will talk about that next week. And then week after that, we'll talk about some other things. I got several things I want to cover, including the... Well, we haven't even got to some of the fun stuff I want to talk about. There's so much we could talk about, so much we could talk about. I'm having to pick and choose. Let's talk about this and not that. all right. Would anyone like to close us in prayer? All right, thank you.